Many of you will know that we're doing a series at the moment in the book of Exodus, looking at God's people once they'd escaped from slavery in Egypt, but before they'd reached the land that had been promised to them whilst they were wandering in the wilderness. I'm just going to adjust this a sec. There we are, a lot better. Now, one of the reasons we're looking at this book of Exodus is, as Tim explained last week, the obvious parallels between the people of Israel then, who had been saved from Egypt, but hadn't yet reached this land that had been promised to them, and the position of Christians today, who've been saved from the consequences of their own rebellion against God, but have yet to reach the new heaven and new earth that God has promised. Now, this morning I'm going to test your manual dexterity, because we're going to read three different passages, which we're going to hopefully put up there. There we are, with page numbers and everything. So Darren's going to come and read the passage from Exodus and two passages from the New Testament. One of them gives the meaning of the Exodus passage. One of them gives the application of the Exodus passage. So Darren's going to come and read to us now. Do please follow as he does so.
Okay, so first passage, this is Exodus 17, 1-7. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Next passage, 1 Corinthians 10, 1-5. "For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud, and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." Hebrews 3. 7-13. "So, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion, during the time of testing in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested and tried me, though for 40 years they saw what I did. That is why I was angry with that generation. I said, their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness."
Thanks very much, Darren. Now, you wouldn't know it from the weather yesterday, but we're in the middle of a drought currently in the UK. Many of you will have seen the news reports a little while ago about farmers in East Anglia entering into talks with the government about what can be done to help them because their crops suffered because of the unseasonal heat and dryness of spring. But there's a larger drought that continues irrespective of how many weekends we have like this when rain is falling. And that's a drought of happiness, of fulfillment, and of purpose. People everywhere are looking for something that gives their lives meaning, and they're prepared to make huge sacrifices to get it. By way of illustration, I came across an example in one of the Sunday papers about what professional dancers in London have to go through. This is what the article says. They have no future doing what they're doing, even though they've hustled and sweated themselves to the heights of one of Britain's most competitive professions. But still they go every morning to their grim upstairs rooms in gyms and their back street, backstage West End doors to dance. In London, it's about who you know and how you look. These days, even auditions are becoming rare as choreographers call in talent from the blessed pool of their own chosen. It takes less time, you see. It's cheaper. And you've got to be the right height, have the right face and hair and clothes. But you can't say anything about the unfairness. You have to ignore it. Keep your head down. Keep working. You're in London now. It's all business. It's all heartless. You are one of many, one of nothing. The sooner you accept that, the more successful you'll be. Fleets of talented dancers who try don't make it. And many of those don't because they simply can't process the ruthlessness. To dance in London is hard on the soul. So why do they do it? It's impossible once you reach your mid-30s. The sight of aging dreamers being rejected in audition after audition is common. The kids watch them leave and pray they don't end up like these ancients, hopelessly, helplessly defiant in the face of the miserable truth. But it's those massed ranks of enchanted eyes that pull most dancers back into the hundreds deep audition queues. It's those ecstatic strangers. One of the dancers, Carl, jokes that when he retires, he's going to make a DVD of people applauding and put it on when his missing it gets too much. Kerry, another dancer, puts it best. I'm looking before we go on stage at all the people, and you can actually see all their faces right to the back. And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, what am I doing here, half shaking? Then the music comes on, you switch on, and you do it. It's like the biggest feeling. I can't explain the buzz, I just can't explain it. Everyone has something which gives their life meaning and which they will sacrifice almost anything to get or keep. Now the dancers in that article get their meaning in life from the buzz and from the applause of the audience. And they're prepared to put up with the unfairness, with the bad treatment, and the insecurity as a result. What gives your life meaning? It's too glib for those of us who call ourselves Christians to say that our life is given meaning by faith in Jesus without examining if that's actually true. If you say that you believe that Jesus gives your life meaning, you'll see if that's true or not when things start to go wrong. If you're in a relationship that fails, if you lose a large amount of money, if something goes wrong with your children, then if your life is given meaning by Jesus, you'll be hit hard, for sure. But if your life is given meaning by that relationship, and by your wealth, and by the success of your children, then if that person who you love tells you that they're giving up on you, if you lose money, if your children who've always been successful mess up, you will be devastated. It can literally kill you. One of the effects that many of you may have heard of the financial crisis in 2008 was that some people who were heads of businesses that had failed or who'd lost lots of money took their own lives. Even though they remained fabulously wealthy and had more money than they could spend. They did that because the reason for their existence, their success in business, had failed them. You may say that Jesus gives your life meaning. Well, what do you really believe? Do you really believe that? Or do you really believe something else? What actually drives your thoughts and actions? Well, in the Exodus passage this morning, we see the Israelites in need of something fundamental to their life. Water. Clearly, without water in the desert, they couldn't live. And they had no water. They started to argue. They started to complain. And they looked back with fondness to their time as slaves in Egypt, when they were oppressed, but at least they had water. They'd forgotten that relatively recently God had parted the waters of the Red Sea for them and was able to perform miracles to save them. They started to disrespect God and his rescue of them, and their anger at being deprived of the thing they needed to live got murderous. As Moses told God, they're ready to stone him. What does God do? Well, he provides water where there is none by Moses taking his staff and striking a rock. A rather strange episode. What does it mean? Well, in the context of the Exodus story, it shows how God provides for his people. It shows the people of Israel how they should rely on God's provision and trust in him to save them from destruction, this time from thirst. It shows how God cares for his people even when they grumble and show ingratitude towards him. That's a good lesson to learn. But the first New Testament passage that Darren read extends and enhances this meaning radically. Do turn up to page 108, 6 and 7. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 10. What we've got there is an example of something called enhanced reality. Hands up if you've heard of enhanced reality. Who are the techno boffins in the congregation this morning? None. Boy, we're all backward, aren't we? Well, look, enhanced reality is something that I first heard of on the BBC London News a few months ago. And here's the idea. In the future, there will be posters up of films. There'll be pictures in the newspaper. And with these posters and with these pictures, if you hold your iPad or similar geeky gadget up towards it, then the poster stops being a poster, starts becoming a trailer for the film. The newspaper picture stops becoming a newspaper picture, starts becoming a report of the story. All very impressive. There's a hidden reality behind the poster, behind the newspaper story. Well, here the 1 Corinthians 10 passage shows us the hidden reality behind what's happening in Exodus. So from verse 1 of chapter 10, I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud, that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Paul's saying that there's something going on behind the surface here involving Jesus. What does he mean? Well, we need to look at the details back in Exodus. Verse 5 of Exodus 17. The Lord answered Moses, go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. What was this staff, this sort of stick that Moses had? It's a very important detail. Those of you who know the story of the first chapters of Exodus will know of the various signs and wonders, the 10 plagues and all that, that God told Moses he would do basically to batter Pharaoh, the Egyptian leader, to letting the Israelites leave. Now, one of these signs involved Moses striking the river Nile with his staff and the river turning to blood. It's a sign of judgment, turning something that's life-giving, the water, something that's nourishing, into something that brings death. Death to the fish, obviously, and also to those who rely on the water for drinking. Now, here, the staff strikes the rock, but what comes out is the opposite of what happened in Egypt. Fresh drinking water comes out. Do you see something which is a sign of judgment strikes something? That thing bears the blow and brings forth water to drink. Do you see how this ties into the story of Jesus? Paul tells us Jesus is the rock. Jesus is struck by the staff of judgment. Jesus bears the curse that afflicted the River Nile. It brings death, it brings blood. But through this, the people of God are given life. You see, if you had your iPad, if you went back in time and held your iPad up against that rock when it was being struck, you'd have seen Jesus on the cross bearing God's judgment so the people of God don't die but have life. The water that comes from the rock is the sign of life, but the life only comes when the rock is struck with judgment. The rock suffers judgment so the people can live. And we could leave it there, couldn't we? That's a great example as to how the Bible is just one story, not lots of stories, but one story. The story of God saving his people through the death of Jesus. But I don't know if you noticed a common thread through the passages that Darren read out. The common thread is this: none of them is really that positive. Look at how the Exodus passage ends, verse 7. And he called the place Massa and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Not a very hopeful end to that passage, is it? Look at how the 1 Corinthians 10 passage that Darren read ends. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So no happy ending there either. And finally, look at this passage in Hebrews 3. See the warnings that are laid out there. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of testing in the wilderness where your ancestors tested and tried me, though for 40 years they saw what I did. That is why I was angry with that generation. I said, their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. What a devastating statement that is. They shall never enter my rest. God is going to cut his people off. Look, there's a warning for us to heed. Hebrews 3 makes it clear it's a warning against hardness of heart or unbelief, of being deceived by sin. So what I want to do is spend the rest of the sermon on how I think we can heed these warnings. And the key is learning to drink from the rock that is Jesus. Christians are stuck between two realities: what we've escaped from and where we're going. Those who follow Jesus have been set free from slavery to our previous selfish ways. And we're promised that when Jesus returns, we'll live with him forever. But in the meantime, we're strangers in this land. We're people who are in danger of bitterness and hardness of heart, just like the Israelites were in the wilderness. We need to learn to drink from the rock that is Christ, to apply the gospel in our lives, to avoid this hardness of heart. Look with me at Hebrews 3, verses 12 and 13. It makes it clear there are two steps to this. The first part is taking responsibility for our own hearts. Verse 12, see to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. So, don't turn away from God. The second part is relying on the input of others to avoid this hardness of heart. Look at verse 13. Encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. So on the one hand, got inward reflection, inward discipline, if you like, making sure our hearts are focused on God and don't become bitter or hard. On the other hand, you've got this bit of listening to others. Listening to others will help us avoid becoming hard. They'll support, they'll intervene in our lives. Two key messages then. Talk to yourselves, listen to others. Talk to yourselves, listen to others. And immediately three big problems. How can you talk to yourself about your own weaknesses? You're blind to them. We've got so used to putting other things before God that it seems familiar and okay to us. We find it hard to see our greed, our pride, our fear, or anything else that takes us away from a reliance on God and his saving grace. We need help to understand the risk we're in of having a hard heart, because we can't always see it for ourselves. We're blind to it. That's the first big problem. Second big problem, we're very good at pretending everything's okay, aren't we? We're very good at that. Those of you who've been to a movie set will know that if you walk down a street, you can look to the right, you can look to the left, everything looks very impressive. You look behind that facade, things look very different. They're just boards, they're just a movie set. You know, it's not meant to be a complete house or a complete saloon bar, or a complete bank or a complete shop. It's a movie set, it's a facade. Sometimes I think Christians are like that. We've got lots of very impressive appearances to ourselves. But the reality inside is not what you might expect from what you see outside. You see, I don't think anyone properly presents an accurate picture of themselves when they're at church, or really when they're anywhere else public. Sometimes the truth of what is really inside comes out, and it's usually not pretty, when we erupt, perhaps in moments of stress or anger. But soon enough, the facade is back up. So one problem, we're blind. Two problem, we're very good at creating a facade. Third problem, we don't like others getting too close. We don't like others seeing behind the facade. We don't like others interfering or trying to help us in a way that shows up our badness. Generally, we don't give people permission to do this. We'd feel affronted if they tried doing so. We all like our space. Think of it this way. If you're on a tube train, and the tube train stops at one of the major London rail stations, Liverpool Street, Victoria, somewhere like that, everyone piles on. It's absolutely packed. There are people crammed up against each other the whole time. Gradually then, as it goes down the line, it enters. And it leaves you and one other person who got on at the same stop. Now that one other person, when he or she got on at that stop with you, was crammed up against you. You know, you were breathing out what they were breathing in. But let's say that as the tube train pulls away, they stay crammed up against you. What are you going to think? Well, look, you're going to move away. You might even get off the train and wait for the next one to come along because you're going to feel very uncomfortable. I mean, all sorts of boundaries are being crossed. You want to say, back off. We like our space. So three problems. We're blind to what's wrong with us. We present a false picture. We don't like others getting too close. But the key remains in applying this to talk to ourselves and to listen to others. It's crucial. It's crucial to our spiritual health. Each of us will know of people who've packed it in, who've given up, who've decided to stop following Jesus. It's a real risk. It's a life and death matter. It's important. It's difficult. How do we do it? Well, I want to use two examples. I want to use two real-life examples where bitterness has arisen, and in one case the gospel has been applied, in one case it hasn't, to illustrate what it looks like. Now, I know many of you very well. I don't want to embarrass any of you. I'm going to embarrass myself by talking about two areas of sin in my life, one from 20 years ago and one from more recently. In the older example, I didn't talk to myself or listen to others. In the more recent example, I did. So, when I was 18, many moons ago, I went to university. I had been at an all-boys school, and I was extremely frisky around female company. There were lots of very pretty girls around. It was an opportunity to explore who I was away from home and to experience new things. One of the things which appealed was to sleep with girls. I was a bundle of lust, and I also called myself a Christian. But when it came to sex, my Christianity was not a matter of faith, but of fear. Fear that in some way, by sleeping with a girlfriend, I'd ruin everything. I'd be plagued with guilt for the rest of my life. And so whilst I was at university, I didn't sleep with any of my girlfriends. Well, what a good Christian boy. But no, no, all that time, I was bitter about not being able to have sex. It's like the Israelites in the Exodus story this morning who look back to Egypt, where they've escaped from and long to be back there. Never mind, I didn't actually sleep with my girlfriends when I was at university. My time there was full of fear and bitterness. I was desperately in need of some serious intervention. On the outside, boy, the movie set looked sparkling. I was a good Christian boy. On the inside, I was full of sin. And as a result, my time at college was a time when my heart got progressively harder. I got more and more bitter. I had no one who I deputized to challenge me on my attitudes, no one who I'd allowed in that deep. I was blind as to how my heart was getting harder. I was in real danger. What did I need? I needed someone to help me drink from the rock that is Christ. I'll tell you what I would have said to my 18-year-old self. I'd have said this. I'd have reminded myself that sexual abstinence is not a matter of fear, but of faith. I'd have reminded myself that Jesus selflessly gave himself up for me. He gave up not the prospect of new experiences and fulfillment, but the reality of existing ultimate fulfillment in heaven, to come down to earth and die a foul death and be separated for the first time in eternity from his Father. I'd have reminded myself that I should respond to that in gratitude and obedience by not being selfish with my sexuality. I needed someone to tell me I should obey, not out of fear, not because I needed to obey to be accepted, but to obey because I am accepted because of what Jesus has done. There was no one I'd given permission to do that, no one I'd let get close enough, so no one did. Here's the other example. Again, it's an activity that seems Christian on the outside, inside driven by something other than faith, and it's to do with hospitality. My wife Jo and I have been blessed since we got married 17 years ago, always to live in a house with at least one spare room. We love having people to stay with us for a long or short period. We've been extremely lucky with those we have had to stay, and they've been a huge blessing to us. However, I have in the past found myself horrendously overreacting to something a guest might do with a degree of anger that's totally disproportionate. Jo immediately picked up on it and she said, whoa, where did that come from? She challenged me, and she was quite right to do so. And once she challenged me, I came to realize my hospitality was not a matter of faith, but of pride, of being the gracious host who should be acknowledged. I never would have said that, obviously. I never would have said, look, acknowledge me, your gracious host. But it was when I erupted that I realized that was what my heart was set on. I had to talk to myself. I had to look to what Jesus' sacrifice meant to me in the context of hospitality. I had to say to myself, I still have to say to myself, look, it's an ongoing process. I had to say to myself, Jesus took me in when I was spiritually adrift. He prepared a room for me when I was loathsome, when I didn't acknowledge his hospitality. He did so at unknowable inconvenience and cost to him. He didn't act out of pride. It was the opposite. It says in Philippians, he emptied himself of his glory. Only by following his example can I act as I should when people come to stay. And I'm learning that because I listened to Joe and I talked to myself. So, two examples. Look, you'll be different to me. You'll have different blind spots. How are we going to apply this passage? Are we willing to give it a try? Are we willing to deputize others to intervene in our lives? It's very risky. It demands total trust that those you allow in have your best interests at heart. It's very hard to hear someone say to you, you need to address your pride, without shouting back, oh, is that the case? Well, you need to address your greed. Those of us who are married to a Christian spouse have someone we probably already have invited in to some extent, though I'd suggest we need to be explicit in asking our spouses to be good spiritual friends to us, to challenge us like that. But if you are married to a Christian spouse, I don't think it works in just having your spouse fulfill that function. If you need challenging, for instance, in the area of your marriage, it's very hard to listen open-mindedly to someone challenge you when you think that person is the problem, or when you think that person has something to gain. And married couples often share the same blindness around things like money and children. Now, clearly, lots of you are not married as well, and clearly that doesn't work then. And for that reason, married or unmarried, I think it's really important to identify a small group of people of the same gender as you that you invite in deep to take that role in Hebrews 3 verse 13, of encouraging you so that you are not hardened by sin's deceitfulness. You'll need to negotiate carefully with them. You'll need to make sure that everyone in the group is happy with the arrangement. You need to be wise, imaginative, and courageous. Each of you is going to go pretty deep with the others. Each of you is going to allow the others to see behind the facade of the movie set into what lies behind. It'll require guts and imagination to apply the gospel in each other's lives. Now look, hands up, I don't currently have a group like that myself, but I'm in discussions with some guys at the moment to see if it might work for us. And if it doesn't work in that situation, I'll look for another. I do think this is something we need to take seriously. We need to talk to ourselves. We need to listen to others if we want to avoid being deceived by sin. Maybe you feel you don't need this. It's too much. This is only for weaker Christians and that you're fine. I don't share that confidence for me. I look at how Adam and Eve, without a sinful nature, were deceived by sin, and I see the danger. So I'll come back to the question I asked at the beginning. What gives your life meaning today? Where do you turn in the wilderness? What's the driving force in your life? Is it Jesus and what he did on the cross, or is it something else? Being the longing for something forbidden, the desire to be acknowledged, or completely different things? Look, let's examine our own hearts. Let's ask others to help us and apply what Jesus did to our lives as we go. Let's really start being brothers and sisters to each other, to help each other look to the cross. When we're in a time of drought, when we feel lost in the wilderness, we can point each other to the rock of Christ, which sustains us, and learn together to drink from it. Let's pray together. Lord Jesus, I thank you for having taken the blow of God's judgment that brings us life. Lord, as we travel through the wilderness, help us to drink from the rock, to apply your gospel in our lives. Give us the courage to let others see us behind the masks we all wear. Help us keep our hearts soft, just as we will do for them. Help us keep the bond of unity and build us together to be your church, against which not even the gates of hell can stand. Amen.